Our guest tonight, William Henry, we'll be back with him again. If you have a computer, get up to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at some of the symbols he has supplied us. We're going to go through them now, and he'll tell us just what they mean on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with William Henry. William, tell me a little bit about symbols as it relates to Atlantis, and why is it important?
Well, the symbols are a way that we transmit knowledge. It's sort of like the way a symbol works is you have, if you're using an analogy with a computer, you have a logo on your computer screen, or it might say, for example, it might have a W, which stands for Microsoft Word. And when you click on that symbol on your computer screen, there magically appears behind it this whole capability of performing a task. And that's the way I view sacred symbols as well, such as the symbol for Atlantis, which is the concentric rings with a cross in the center. When we click on that symbol and are able to access the tremendous knowledge behind it, it gives us the capability of performing the task that is inherent within that symbol. And in this particular case, what the symbol of Atlantis represents is, on the deepest esoteric level, it represents the transformation of our chaotic self into our divine self that is our birthright.
Okay, let's go through these symbols that you supplied us. Plate one, if you have a computer. If not, William, would you please describe what it looks like for people who don't have the luxury of looking at these? And then just tell us what they mean.
Yeah, it'll be my pleasure. And before I do that, George, can I send all best wishes to Victoria Jack?
Yes, you sure can. I mentioned that last week, too. How's she doing?
Well, I just talked with Tom. I just heard the news that Victoria, who... Heads up
to UFO Expo.
Yes, the Bay Area UFO Expo is not doing so well, and so I just wanted to send her all best wishes and know that everybody has her in her thoughts and prayers here.
So, okay, that's great. Thank you.
The first symbol that we're looking at in plate one, again, we're seeing a comparison of the concentric rings of Atlantis, which shows three concentric rings with a cross in the center. This is called the bullseye, and this is the logo for Atlantis. This ring and cross symbol is literally derived from Plato's description of the enclosure built by the gods to protect the original sacred hill of Atlantis. Now, something that's very important about this symbol to note is this. Jordan Maxwell is one of the preeminent symbolists that we have, and he describes a symbol as a sign. A sign or a symbol indicates direction, like stop or go this way, or it can inform one of ownership. And in a sense, because this enclosure of Atlantis was built by the gods to protect the hybrid gods and humans, it was designed also to keep another set of humans out of Atlantis.
There is meaning behind these symbols.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yes. Yeah, and this is the meaning of it. The meaning of the Atlantis symbol is this place belongs to the gods. Humans keep out is essentially what it says. But we have to ask the question then, what is this saying that humans are to keep away from? And the answer is provided, I believe, by the NASA image that I have also on plate one, which shows an image of a warp craft, which is a term that they borrowed from Star Trek. It shows a craft entering a wormhole that is depicted as concentric rings, just like the symbol of Atlantis. But what we see here is that the two-dimensional image of the rings, the concentric rings, actually symbolizes a three-dimensional experience, the experience of going through a gateway. Now, in the language of symbolism, whenever you see that the two-dimensional image of the concentric rings, we're allowed to then apply this imagery to it, this meaning to it, and what it indicates is that when we see the 2D image of Atlantis, the concentric rings, it represents a 3D experience of the gateway, and that means that what the gods were ultimately protecting was a gateway.
Okay, see, and I see what you're doing here too, is you're giving us an image of something modern today, like this NASA image.
Yes.
And then you're comparing it to the ancient image to see the correlation.
That's right, because literally, George, the three-dimensional perspective was not rediscovered, if you will, until Da Vinci's painting of the Last Supper during the Renaissance. So it's only been within the past 400 years that we have this three-dimensional perspective in artwork. Here, before that, everything was two-dimensional, and we had to extrapolate with our imagination that when we see the 2D image, it's actually representing a three-dimensional experience.
So you're saying, though, that they knew back then of either wormholes or black holes, right?
That's exactly right. And in fact, again, to riff on the work of Dr. Paula Violette, he also uses this same imagery that I'm presenting tonight, the logo of Atlantis, to suggest that it's not necessarily the gateway that I present, although it could be. He's saying that that represents the ultimate science of subatomic particles. So we have very sound scientific reasons for believing that this imagery is, in fact, encoding advanced scientific knowledge.
Now, how did they know this then, back thousands and thousands of years ago?
Well, if we operate from the premise that Plato was operating from, this symbolism would have been telepathically communicated to humanity by the gods themselves. Now, that god in particular would be Poseidon in the Atlantis story. It also involves the god Zeus, who is at the center of the Milky Way galaxy and the wisdom center there. We know them perhaps better as the Anunnaki gods, Enki and Enlil, because those two Sumerian gods are simply retooled versions of Poseidon and Zeus are retooled versions of the original Sumerian gods.
But extraterrestrials.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
There you go. Yes. Let's call them Anunnaki, which is a very broad term for beings who came to Earth from the heavens.
What's remarkable, William, as various civilizations talk about the same thing, how could they be wrong?
Well, that's right. And I think what we're looking at here is that analogy of a mirror that was shattered. And various cultures pick up a piece of that mirror in the form of symbols and say, aha, here is the whole truth. But in fact, what they have is a piece of the whole truth. And that's what I believe we're looking at with this imagery that we're exploring tonight, is pieces of the whole truth.
All right, let's go to plate number two. What are we looking at here?
Plate number two is what it portrays is an hourglass shape. That is a design that came from 1882 in Japan, and it portrays the world pillar called Meru, which is the name of the center of Atlantis. Meru is also called the Holy Mountain. It's the glorious shining peak that one encounters in virtually every culture, and we find it in essentially all religions and sacred traditions concerning paradise. In fact, we're told that that the people of Atlantis were called the people of Meru after this world pillar. And when you compare the hourglass shape of the world pillar that came down through this Buddhist drawing with a modern depiction of a wormhole, we have a near perfect match.
Why do they seem to be so fascinated with wormholes?
Well, because in my view, the story of the gate of the gods is the ultimate myth, going back to the story of the Garden of Eden, which again compares quite nicely with the Atlantis story. Humankind at one time lived in a paradisical realm, but then through some form of a transgression, either the dilution of our divine essence in the Atlantis story, or because Eve ate or received the forbidden knowledge, we were evicted from that paradise. And in the Garden of Eden story in the book of Genesis, after the Old Testament God Yahweh evicted us from the garden, he placed cherubim on either side of the gate of Eden and placed a flaming sword in that gate in order to protect it. That's exactly the Atlantis story. That is exactly what the gods did in building this enclosure of Atlantis, symbolized by the concentric rings with the cross in the center. And from that time forward, it has been humankind's quest to reclaim that gate, to actually be able to re-enter that paradisical realm. And in my view, what that is, ultimately, is our ascension into, again, Michio Kaku's Type 2 civilization, a civilization that uses the power of the sun to supply its enormous energy needs, colonizes our local star system, and then eventually is able to control the power of an entire galaxy and manipulate space-time to become time travelers.
The television show Stargate, which is on Sci-Fi, which takes a lot of these things, William, and then illustrates them, of course, with some pretty interesting television, has been a very successful show for the Sci-Fi network for years, primarily because of the interest in this.
Absolutely. I don't watch Stargate or Stargate Atlantis, although I would love to talk with the writers of that show and show them some of this imagery, because what they're describing here is not just, is not necessarily science fiction. I mean, according to this imagery here, this knowledge has been floating around in the consciousness of humanity for a very long time, and we are now coming into a position here in this golden moment, as I call it, where we can assemble this capability and literally transform our species.
Plate number three I find very fascinating because it talks about the collapse of that world pillar. Explain these plates.
This one is mind-blowing, isn't it? Because what we see are primarily two figures. There's one that's holding a sheet that is preparing to cover the collapse of the world pillar, Meru, again in the shape of the hourglass figure. In this image as well, it shows, it has, of course, the concentric rings symbol as well, but it shows the collapse of Meru, and coming from it appear to be these sort of curious crystal type things that may represent other dimensions. And what it says to me is that Meru is or was a wormhole, a gateway that was open, but then it collapsed. Suddenly, the civilization collapsed, which is what happened to Atlantis. And it suggests to me that the submersion of Atlantis has more to do with the collapse of a gateway into the heavens, vis-a-vis perhaps some cataclysm or some premeditated act, perhaps even an act of warfare by the gods against humankind. Either way, this wormhole, this gateway to the stars, collapsed. And what I'm showing in plate three here is that the way that the Buddhists portrayed the collapse of Meru perfectly matches the way modern science portrays the collapse of a wormhole.
Well, that's true. And the way you've got it illustrated points that out.
Yeah. So it's, again, suggesting, showing the complete story here that this gateway existed, but then through some cataclysmic event, the gateway collapsed. And once again, we find ourselves on the long march to reclaim the secrets of this gate.
All right, now plate number four is a wild-looking thing. Tell what the heck are we looking at here?
It is a wild-looking thing. What we're looking at is a drawing from a second-century Chinese manuscript of Mount Meru, which, again, is the name of the center of Atlantis. And it looks, at first glance, like we're looking at some kind of an antenna.
Yes.
In fact, that's what Mongolian myth says this thing is, that the world...
Or it looks like one of those things, William, from those old sci-fi movies, you know, like a pulse machine or something like that, and those coils would all light up in those real early sci-fi flicks.
Yeah, very good, George, because actually I was in Florida giving a lecture on this subject a few years ago, and a scientist came up to me after my talk, and he said, "Hey, I was basically asleep through your presentation until you put up that blueprint." And I said, "What blueprint?"
Yeah, really.
And he went through my slides until he came to this very drawing that we're looking at right now, and he said, "I design particle beam weapons for a living, you know, Star Wars-type weapons."
Mm-hmm.
So what you're looking at there is a blueprint for a particle beam weapon.
That's interesting. I was going to say something like that. It's some kind of accelerator or weapon.
That's what it is. It's a particle accelerator. And the question is, what is a blueprint for a particle accelerator doing in a second century Chinese manuscript?
And how did it get there?
And how did it get there? It was found in what is called a cache called the Dunhuang or Tunhuang manuscripts, which is a sort of Buddhist hall of records that was discovered in the early 1900s. And I was just came upon it by chance in a book on the sacred mountains of Asia. And that was a number of years ago. That was 1999. And I've spent the interim trying to understand this device. And the amazing thing is that this is a diagram of Meru. It is unquestionably a diagram of some kind of a pulse weapon or a particle accelerator, a device that that advanced theoretical physicists proposed could be used to build. We could build a giant space-based particle accelerator to open stargates and wormholes.
If they were able to have that technology, somebody obviously gave it to them, or we're dealing with a civilization that was extremely advanced, and we somehow lost for years that kind of know-how and technology.
Well, that is the proposal that, you know, building on the works of Zachariah Sitchin, who said that the Anunnaki, when they came here, were at least 3,000 years in advance, technologically speaking, of where we're at today.
And so at least.
And so, again, to refer to Michio Kaku, he proposes it's going to take us about 1,000 years to become, to be powerful enough to control the power of our entire galaxy and to become time travelers. But maybe they already had that capability long ago. And that's the suggestion that I'm making here, and we'll talk about as we continue, that the Anunnaki did not come here in rocket-powered ships, as Sitchin proposes. He was looking at it from the lens of the mid-70s. Looking at it from the lens of the early 21st century, we can clearly see that this device is what would be required for time travel. And perhaps the Anunnaki are the ones responsible for bringing this device here, and if that's so, they traveled the galaxy as time travelers in warp craft.
Plate 5, similar to Plate 4?
Plate 5, yes. I took that scientist challenge in Florida. He said, look, you're dealing with a particle accelerator here. So I did some digging, and I was able to find one of the first particle accelerators that was designed by Ernesto Livermore, in the early 1920s, and it was used in atom smashing experiments. And I show a comparison here of this particle accelerator designed by Livermore with the second century Chinese drawing, and they're a virtual match as well.
I got to tell you, the graphic that you supplied for the plate, to me, if you're looking at it, William, right on the right hand side, it looks like some small creature standing by it. Do you see, like, it looks like two eyes and a mouth?
Yes. Isn't that interesting? Yes, very interesting.
Two arms and two legs. Look at it.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. In fact, that the base of this construction, in fact, is a virtual ringer for a uterus as well, which is maybe why you're picking up on that human imagery there. This is just amazing stuff, and I have been working with the second century drawing for a few years, and then just last year I came in contact with an artist named Jack Andrews, who had a real Central Asian feel to his artwork, and asked him to render this in 3D, and that's the imagery that we're looking at here. And we can see that when we take this two-dimensional drawing and insert it into a 3D computer program, it brings it to life in a truly remarkable way.
When we come back, William, we'll look at plate 6 and 7. 7 will blow your mind, everybody. And I'm beginning to wonder if, for example, the Bermuda Triangle might be some kind of stargate or portal. Who knows? We'll ask William that question when we come back. Well, next hour, we'll turn over the phones to you. You can ask William Henry a question about some of the things we're talking about. When we come back, we'll finish these two plates that are left, plates 6 and 7. They're on the coasttocoastam.com website. And then I want to talk with William about these portals, these stargates, these wormholes. Could the Bermuda Triangle be in one of them, for example? We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. William, we'll go to plate six and then seven and many questions about these portals and wormholes and stargates. But explain plate six for us, if you would.
What we're looking at now is a drawing that was etched onto a gold plate that was presented to King Tutankhamun by Nubian goldsmiths in around 1400 BC. And this is the image that is one of the centerpieces of Zachariah Sitchin's books. He proposes that what we're looking at here is an Anunnaki Shem craft, an Anunnaki spacecraft, a rocket ship, sitting on top of a missile silo. And that's, you know, quite a, you know, an interesting proposition there. In fact, I was in Memphis giving a talk to a Mensa Society group one night about this, and I put this up and said, this is, you know, Zachariah Sitchin proposes this is a rocket ship. And one of the geniuses in the crowd said, oh, that's not a rocket ship, that's a snow cone. It does look like a snow cone, to be honest. And so,
I don't know. It does look like an Apollo capsule.
It does. It absolutely does. So somewhere in between a snow cone and Apollo capsule may be what we're looking at here. But again, getting back to our drawing or depiction from the second century of this Meru particle accelerator, we see at the apex of that drawing a triangular apex. And when I work with artists such as Jack Andrews or with Dana Augustine, I always try to withhold information. I don't even tell them sometimes what we're actually working on. And that was the experience that Jack had. He's like, I don't know what this thing is, but it's blowing my mind. And what it ended up showing to us is that the apex of this Meru drawing was in fact some form of a cone-shaped craft that appeared to be ejected from the particle accelerator at the very base of this pillar. And this is where I started really hypothesizing that what we're actually looking at here in Sitchin's drawing from the Nubian goldsmiths, as well as from this second century Meru drawing, is actually some form of a warp craft, again, to use NASA's term borrowed from Star Trek, that is ejected or travels through these gateways.
What if it's a missile silo, William? I mean, you know, there has been talk that we've had past nuclear disasters on this planet, maybe from high sophisticated ancient civilizations. What if this is a missile?
Well, it could be a missile, George, save for the fact that in particular here in this this Nubian depiction presented to Tutankhamun, underneath the ground we see two figures that have their backs turned to a pillar in between the two of them. And the pillar that they stand in between is the pillar of Osiris, which, according to Egyptian myth and religion, is the symbol for resurrection and ascension. So in this particular instance, it's likely that we're not looking at some form of a weapon system. Rather, we're looking at some form of a spiritual technology, and that this craft that is portrayed on the top of the ground here has something to do with ascension and resurrection, which is essentially stepping into higher dimensions.
You know what? Wouldn't it be something if the Apollo scientists, the Wernher von Braun's of years gone back, used this kind of depiction to create the Apollo and the Saturn rocket and exactly what those spaceships looked like?
It would not surprise me at all. In fact, I'm convinced that when FDR sent Nicholas Rurik to Mongolia, to Central Asia, in search of the secrets of the Holy Grail, that what he was actually in search of was this type of ancient technology that we're describing. And by the way, just to tie a knot here between our present and earlier discussion, I'm really proud of Dana Augustine's depiction of the New Atlantis. And again, what he shows at the center of that image is this cone that is emerging from the very center of Atlantis, and that cone is in fact this warp craft ascending from the center of Atlantis.
And of course, plate 7 will blow your mind after you explain this to people.
I hope you have a real sense of humor here, because you have to get this. What it shows is a comparison of the cross of Atlantis, which again shows a canal entering three concentric rings with a cross in the center. And what we see is that that is exactly the symbol or the stage upon which President Bush stood on August 30th, 2004 at the GOP convention in New York City. He gave his speech while standing in the seal of Atlantis. Now,
look at that.
It's absolutely astonishing, and there's no way that this happened by chance. Karl Rove had to have been sending a message directly to those in the know that America is the new Atlantis, and President Bush is the king of the new Atlantis. In fact, at the end of the speech...
Symbolism.
Unless you can read the language, you're ignorant. And unfortunately, most Americans are ignorant of the language of symbolism. That's not a criticism. That's a fact. We just don't know what symbols mean, which means we're uneducated. And we must educate ourselves in the meaning of the symbols that is being used in these propaganda campaigns.
I bet Jordan Maxwell had a field day with this one.
I hope Jordan has seen it. I'll have to get in touch with him and see what he thinks. I wanted to comment on the statement that President Bush used to conclude his speech. Again, he's standing in the seal of Atlantis, which is built up on top of concentric rings. It's an extraordinary scene. And in fact, Karl Rove was asked about this during the preamble to that speech, and his only comment was is that the press was focused on the alleged subliminal crosses that were embedded within the podium that the president was standing in front of. So I don't know about the subliminal crosses, but clearly he's standing in the seal of Atlantis. And at the end of the speech, he says, like generations before us, we have a calling from beyond the stars to stand for freedom. This, he says, is the everlasting dream of America. And tonight, in this place, while he's standing in the seal of Atlantis, that dream is renewed. And in my opinion, what he's saying is that the dream of the new Atlantis is renewed in America today.
Tell me about some of these stargates and some of these portals, William. Is it possible that the Bermuda Triangle might be within where one or two of these may be?
Well, it's possible. Again, we don't have the scientific data that would present a final solution such as that. But what we have is all the incredibly anomalous things that have happened in the Bermuda Triangle. We might more properly call it the Bermuda Vortex. And what we have to do is initiate a thorough study of this phenomena here. You know, both of us, remember, I grew up in the Detroit area. And
as I did. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, these anomalies are reported in the Great Lakes as well. Most people don't realize that there's areas of strong magnetic disturbance in Lake Ontario, for example. And even present-day navigation charts talk about they label 14 areas of magnetic anomalies in Lake Ontario alone, with thousands of ships having disappeared in the Great Lakes over the years.
Same with Lake Superior.
Same with Lake Superior, exactly. So we've got these regions around the planet, and so you know, you follow the story, and lo and behold, what you find around Lake Superior is ancient Michigan legends of Egyptians coming over to the Lake Superior area and hauling out thousands of tons of copper, taking it back to Egypt and other parts. And we just wonder, what is really going on in some of these areas?
Would you relate the story of what you think might be in Iraq with regards to these stargates?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've been focusing on that story for a number of years now. We've talked about it off and on in terms of Saddam Hussein's belief that he is the reincarnated biblical king Nebuchadnezzar, whose story recorded in the book of Daniel records the opening of a gateway of some kind through which three wise men entered and returned with one like, or actually the Son of God in tow, depending upon the version of the story that you read. And that's a vital example of a gateway story, because Nebuchadnezzar, in turn, believed that he was the reincarnated biblical king Nimrod. And it was Nimrod who built the Tower of Babel, a word that originally meant gate. He assembled humankind to build the gate to the heavens. But again, the gods said, not so fast. We're not ready for company just now. And they destroyed our tower and separated us by language.
These portals, these stargates, could you accidentally stumble into one and, you know, like a Twilight Zone movie, be in another dimension? Or do you have to get into it with some different kinds of consciousness?
Well, certainly I would prefer to enter it through the right and proper consciousness. I haven't come across any stories of people stumbling into them. Alice in Wonderland is of course, a fictional take on that very concept right there.
That's a good point.
I think it has to be, a person has to be a highly advanced consciousness before they can perceive or, in fact, begin to travel these gateways. And again, you know, there's what we're assembling today through various disciplines is the means by which we can transform ourselves, reclaim that divine essence within ourselves, which is our birthright, and become stargate travelers or time travelers.
Some people believe that America is the new Atlantis. What's your take?
Well, I mean, that's a phenomenal concept. It goes back to Sir Francis Bacon, who published a book. Well, actually, the book was published in 1627, the year after he died. The book was called The New Atlantis, and it prophesied the emergence of a technologically and spiritually advanced civilization in America that would have as its center a pillar or column of light, which I think is the same as this particle accelerator that we've been describing.
The New Atlantis was prophesized 1600s?
1627, that's right.
The thought of this, does it mean that they think we're going to sink as well?
Well, the prophecy of the New Atlantis is more about ascension that it is a cataclysm of some kind. It's about reclaiming this divine greatness, and that's why it's the ultimate story, because it's the ultimate carrot, really, that's in front of all of us, that if we can achieve this, we're going to be a transformed species. And throughout American history, we've had figures such as Thomas Jefferson who have been involved in this mystery. It's claimed that Jefferson actually possessed missing chapters of Bacon's New Atlantis, and that these works are hidden or concealed within the cornerstone of the U.S. Capitol, for example. So it's one of these ideas that always represents the ideal. It represents something that we may or may not be able to achieve, but the point is we have to pursue it.
How much of your work in research deals with extraterrestrial life or visitation?
Well, I'm constantly encountering it. It's one of the primary lenses through which I view myth and scripture. I mean, I certainly believe in many different forms of other dimensional beings. You have the literal physical beings, and you have the more etheric types. And so it's a constant within my research.
So it doesn't stop?
It does not stop. No, absolutely not. And, you know, what an exciting time to be doing this kind of research as well, because for the first time in a couple of thousand years, some of the key texts are finally available to us. Those I referenced earlier, the Hypostasis of the Archons that I wrote about in Oracle of the Illuminati. I mean, it clearly spells out, according to the first Christians, here is the deal. You have come to this planet. You don't belong here. You have a divine particle within you. There's this extraterrestrial race out here called the Archons, or rulers, that have what you want. And they're going to do just about anything they can to get it from you, including setting up a material world that will be a world of distraction to your soul that will keep you off your true spiritual purpose. And so when you start with stories like that, you have to incorporate the extraterrestrial perspective. Otherwise, you know, none of this really makes any sense.
You do not believe they're benevolent creatures?
Well, no, I think that there are those that are benevolent, but there are certainly others that are in competition with us that would like to take, again, that divine particle from within us.
Basically, that's almost the theory of David Jacobs, who believes that these aren't nice entities.
Well, yeah, again, I'm not familiar with his work, but he would most certainly benefit from reading the Hypostasis of the Archons.
Of everything that you've done now, William, you and I, we've talked over the last 4 years. Man, it's going to be five in April, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
That's how fast time flies. Well, in your research, what one thing still baffles you? There's got to be something.
The ultimate question to me is still, what is the human body? I mean, we completely take for granted this flesh and blood vehicle that our soul is transported in. And what baffles me is why aren't we taught the spiritual capabilities of our bodies? Why is the human body so suppressed? Why can't we talk about the excretions and the secretions of the human body in public? You know, those seven dirty words that you can't say on radio or television all refer to the excretions of the body. And I believe it's because ultimately there is a conspiracy, literally, to withhold the knowledge of the sacred secretions our body is capable of creating. That if we could learn how to harness the power of this body and move this spiritual energy through it, it would release secretions from our pineal gland that contain all the secrets of the universe. And this would cause the virtual instant transmutation of our species if we were raised from the time we're young to know that our body is, in fact, the stairway to heaven of myth and scripture.
You are a believer in the afterlife, I believe, right?
Yes.
Always have been?
Well, I suppose so. I believe in reincarnation, although I'm not sure of any of my past lives. It's just an inner knowing that I have. And I certainly believe in the afterlife. I mean, especially when you consider, you know, the way our consciousness is expanding today and our connection to not just other solar systems within our galaxy, but other galaxies within the universe. I mean, it's to me without question that there are passageways linking the universe and that our soul's ultimate quest here on Earth is to claim that ring or vibration of cosmic sovereignty that the gods wish for us to have, so that we can enjoy the afterlife traveling the magnificent universe that we're all a part of.
We're going to open up the phone lines next hour, William. I can't believe we're racing into hour number three with you. Your website, williamhenry.net. Any recommendations to people when they go to the site?
Yeah, check out the, I have an article up on the Stargate of Atlantis. And I'd encourage anybody who's interested in the story to get a copy of my Stargate 2012 DVD or Stargates of the Gods DVD, because it's got a lot of this imagery as well as my my lecture presentation on this subject.
All right, William Henry has been our guest. And what are you working on next, William?
Well, I've got a couple of things I'm working on. I'm actually going to be finishing up this book on Atlantis next year, which is going to be finished once I get some additional research done in Egypt in March, again, with going with Freddie Silva.
Right.
And then getting some additional data on cosmic rays emanating from the center of the galaxy, and that'll represent the second half of this Atlantis discussion. And I've also got a book coming out in November called The Illuminator, which is about the myths and mysteries of Mary Magdalene.
That'll be interesting, too. We'll stay with us. We'll open up the phone lines. Our special guest tonight is William Henry. Now it's your turn. We'll talk about stargates, portals, you name it. You know, William, we'll be back.